Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Heartbreaking doesn't even begin to define my torture. I continue to search for them each day, hoping this is just a wretched nightmare. My searching ends when I am again enveloped by the fallout from their deaths. Living the daily horror has hardened my soul. That is a quote from a victim impact statement from the family I will be discussing today. I was so moved by her words. It is one of the most brutally eloquent statements I have ever read. The mass murder of a family is beyond shocking. Any violent death is difficult to accept, and surviving loved ones are forever changed. But when you lose an entire family, snuffed out so quickly and so cruelly, the fabric of everyday life is no longer meaningful. Even if the killer is brought to justice, there is rarely closure, possibly relief that the killer will be punished, but closure is largely a myth. It's a buzzword. And it's a word that often offends or irritates the family and friends who are left behind to try to pick up the pieces of their lives. I have always felt that grief never actually stops. You are not given respite. You learn to live with it. But how can you learn to live with the annihilation of a family? Day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute, you are left only with your memories, and your memories are often haunted by the trauma of violence, colored by blood, soaked in your never-ending tears. Finding peace is an act of will. Closure is a fable we need to believe, but in our hearts, we know it's a lie. Welcome to episode 157, The Champion Family Murders. If you travel around 100 miles northwest of Nashville, Tennessee, you'll reach the Land Between the Lakes, a national recreation area encompassing a peninsula located directly between Kentucky Lake and Lake Barkley. It's an absolutely beautiful area composed of vast forests, open lands, and streams. I got the chance to camp at LBL with my classmates when I was in the sixth grade, and it is an experience I have never forgotten. It was so much fun, of course, but also, even to a kid, it was just breathtakingly beautiful. 10 miles east of the Land Between the Lakes is the county seat of Trigg County, Kentucky, Cades, a small town of around 2,500 residents. It's the type of place where everyone knows everyone. Cades tourism website, gocades.com, boasts that the town ain't no Disneyland, and that's what people really like about this place. Or, as the city's official website puts it, Cades is the South's best-kept secret. I think what they mean is that the city isn't a tourist trap. It is a genuine, slow-paced, small southern town with a charming historic downtown, sprinkled with art and antique stores. GoCades.com also boasts about the town's low crime rate, stating, "Remember when strangers greeted you with a smile, and your parents were fine with you playing outside till after dark? Well, that's this place." Cades sounds like a great place to raise a family. It's located near a beautiful recreation area. There are few tourists, and most importantly, there's very little violent crime. Residents feel safe in their own homes and around their neighbors. It's a safe haven for Western Kentuckians. The total crime risk index score for Cades is 34, which is 37 points below the statewide crime risk score of 71 and 66 points below the national crime risk score of 100. All of those things were true for the residents who lived in Cades in 2014 when today's story takes place. However, those feelings of safety and comfort would come to a screeching halt on October 26, 2014, when three members of the well-liked and well-respected Champion family were found dead in their rural Katie's farmhouse. Just before 11:45 that morning, 36-year-old Ryan Champion banged on his Aunt Lisa's door. He had run all the way from his parents' house, which was a few acres away, across the street. When Lisa answered the door, Ryan yelled at her to call the police. There was a gun in one hand and duct tape on his wrists. Lisa dialed 911 and spoke with an operator, relaying whatever Ryan could manage to tell her. Lisa was able to gather that some guy, who liked Ryan's sister Emily, had busted into the house and did something to them. Lisa asked Ryan if they needed an ambulance, and he said yes. When emergency responders arrived at the Champion house on Old Dover Road, they found the bodies of three members of the Champion family, Lindsay, Joy, and their daughter Emily. But there was also a fourth body, who authorities assumed was the man who had busted into the home and killed everyone. At first, the Champion murders seemed like an open and shut case. A madman, obsessed with Emily, had attacked the family. Ryan fought back and was able to kill the man before escaping. He was a survivor. But as investigators unraveled all the strings, it became apparent that this case wasn't open and shut after all. What investigators discovered completely shocked the small town of Katie's. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Lindsay, the patriarch of the Champion family, was born on April 13, 1952 in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, to parents Boyd and Doris. Even into adulthood, he was very close to his sister Lisa and brother Lauren. In the late 1950s, the Champion family moved 20 miles west of Hopkinsville to a farm on Old Dover Road in Katie's. More than 50 years later, when this story takes place, Lisa was still living in the family's farmhouse. In fact, she still lives there as of this recording. Lisa later described her brother in a victim impact statement as being a kind and hardworking man who gave his time and self to the community. Family friends told Oxygen that Lindsay Champion was a funny man with a dry sense of humor. In 1970, Lindsay graduated from Trigg County High School. While there, he met and fell in love with his high school sweetheart, Joy, who was described as being one of a kind. She was a kind-hearted woman, a great listener, and a mother to all, but she didn't pull any punches. Joy Madeline Allen was born on May 6, 1954 in Trigg County to parents John and Madeline. We don't know much about Joy's childhood, other than her mother died tragically from brain cancer. Watching their mother die slowly was a very difficult thing for Joy and her sisters to witness. In 1972, Joy graduated Trigg County High School, where she met Lindsay Champion. On July 8th, shortly after Joy graduated, she and Lindsay married. The newlyweds moved into a farmhouse across the street from his parents on Old Dover Road in Katie's. Joy and Lindsay's ranch-style 1,700-square-foot brick home featured three bedrooms, two baths, and a red front door, a concrete front porch with four white pillars. The house sat on 24 acres and was surrounded by trees with a winding driveway. It was picturesque. In 1974, Lindsay graduated from Western Kentucky University with a degree in mathematics and business finance. He went on to work at the local Farm Credit Services office in Hopkinsville. According to his obituary, Lindsay's job was to serve the agricultural needs of local farmers in the surrounding counties. Lindsay also served as a board member of the Trigg County Board of Education and the County Cattlemen's Association and helped his siblings run the family farm. In 1976, Joy graduated from Murray State University with a degree in elementary education. She went to work at Trigg County Elementary School, where she was described as being a dedicated educator who loved her students. Joy was also a member of the Trigg County Riding Club. She absolutely loved anything horse-related, including showing horses and racing horses. Joy and Lindsay were members of the Katy's Church of Christ. Lindsay was an elder and lay speaker, and both were Sunday school teachers. They were both known as being sources of inspiration and encouragement to everyone. They were well-respected and well-liked pillars of the Katy's community. Joy and Lindsay settled into their marriage and careers. Everything was almost perfect. The only thing missing for the couple was a baby. They tried for years, but sadly, Joy suffered numerous miscarriages. In March 1978, the Champions thought their dreams had finally come true when they welcomed a son named Austin. But he died tragically the same day he was born. It was another devastating blow for the couple. They could not stand the idea of another traumatizing birth or miscarriage. So in December of 1978 or January of 79, Joy and Lindsay adopted a baby boy who had been born in September of 1978. Ryan Lindsay Champion, who was about 3 or 4 months old when Lindsay and Joy adopted him, was absolutely everything the Champions had dreamed of. Lindsay's sister Lisa told Oxygen, "It was like he was their own child." Then on April 29, 1983, when Ryan was nearly 5 years old, Joy gave birth to Emily Catherine. She was their miracle baby, and they felt that the Champion family was finally complete. According to family and friends, Joy and Lindsay treated both of their children equally. Their love for Ryan and Emily was the same. It did not matter that Ryan had been adopted. He was their son, plain and simple. By all accounts, Emily and Ryan had an idyllic childhood. They spent a lot of time outdoors on the farm, climbing trees and riding horses. Both Champion children graduated from Trigg County High School, just like their parents had. Emily's classmate, Nathan, told the Paducah Sun that he remembered Emily being a treasured friend and driven woman who had a promising future ahead of her. She was the class salutatorian and was voted most likely to succeed. Nathan said, "She always strived to do better, to improve herself, and in turn, she brought many of us with her." In 2004, 3 years after high school, Emily graduated from Western Kentucky University with a degree in animal science. Her passion for horses had extended way beyond childhood. Emily knew, from the time that she was a little girl, that she wanted to be an equine veterinarian. And that's exactly what she did. In 2008, she graduated from the College of Veterinary Medicine at Auburn University. Following high school, Ryan did not attend college like his sister and parents had. Joy's sister Judy told Oxygen that Ryan was just as bright as Emily, but he just didn't apply himself like she had. Emily set goals, worked hard, and studied, but Ryan didn't want to do that. With no plans for his future, Ryan joined the Army in his mid-20s. He was looking for a sense of purpose. Family friends told Oxygen that the Champions supported Ryan's choice and felt like the military would be a good fit for him. 8 years later, Ryan was discharged. He then moved back to Western Kentucky, this time to Oak Grove, which is around 30 miles away from Katy's. He started working as a contractor, doing construction jobs like tiling bathrooms. At the same time, Emily was more than 600 miles away from home in Sunset, Louisiana, working as a veterinarian for the Barone Clinic, an equine medical and surgical facility that offered call services to local farms, training centers, and racetracks. By the end of October 2014, Joy and Lindsay Champion were both retired. Joy had worked for the Trigg County School System for 30 years and had even been awarded Educator of the Year in 2008. Lindsay worked for Farm Credit Services for 38 years, making it all the way to director before he retired. In 2013, he had been awarded the Friend of Agriculture Award at the annual Trigg County Agricultural Appreciation Dinner. With their retirement, Joy was able to enjoy more time with her horses, while Lindsay joined a local motorcycle riding club that he and his fellow riders affectionately called the Ben Gay Club. Life was good for the couple. Ryan was still working as a contractor, but he had recently been evicted from his Oak Grove apartment and had moved back in temporarily with his parents. Meanwhile, Emily had accepted a new job, which was going to start in November. During the last week of October, Emily was in Katie's visiting her parents before she began her new job in a few days. On Saturday, October 25th, Emily ran the Urban Bourbon Half Marathon. That night, Joy and Lindsay attended a friend's birthday party where they had a great time. The next morning, Joy and Lindsay went to church like they did every Sunday. Emily didn't join them as she was still recovering from the marathon. Ryan didn't go either, although it is unclear why. Just before 11:45 a.m., Lindsay's sister Lisa, who lived across the street from the Champions, heard multiple gunshots going off in the area. She later told Oxygen that she thought the gunshots were unusual for that time of day, but before she could think anything more of it, she heard someone at her door. It was 36-year-old Ryan yelling, "Lisa! Lisa!" He had a pistol in his hand and his wrists were taped with a small amount of duct tape. Ryan asked Lisa to call 911, and she did. She told the operator, quote, "My nephew Ryan Champion just came to my door and his wrists have been tied with duct tape. I haven't been able to find out what's wrong. He doesn't appear to be injured, but I don't know what's happened." Lisa stayed on the phone with the operator trying to get more information out of Ryan. She was able to put together that some guy who liked Emily had busted into the house, but that was about it. Lisa asked her nephew if they needed an ambulance, and he said yes. She told the operator that they needed an ambulance at her brother's house across the street, and then added that she and Ryan were going to go over to the Champion house to wait. Lisa later told Oxygen that she cut the tape off of Ryan's wrists before they drove over to the house. As they pulled up, Lisa asked where everyone was, and Ryan responded, "They're in there. You don't want to go in there." She ignored Ryan and got out of the truck. That's when she saw a bullet hole in the front door. Then she saw her 72-year-old brother lying outside of the house on the concrete front porch. When Lisa approached, she saw that he had been shot in the head. An autopsy would reveal that he had been shot a total of 4 times. Lisa then made her way inside and found 31-year-old Emily, who had also suffered 4 head wounds. Duct tape had been wrapped 7 to 8 times around her face, covering everything from her nose to the bottom of her chin. Emily's hands were duct taped together, Lisa said, real thick, like mittens. Her feet were also duct taped. And in the basement was 70-year-old Joy. She was slumped over, lying with her face on the ground. She had been shot in the face 2 times. Right after Lisa made the gruesome discovery, emergency responders arrived. Sheriff Ray Burnham was one of the first officers on the scene. He knew the family. Joy had been his teacher. Years later, when Burnham spoke to Oxygen, he still broke down crying when describing what he saw that day. Ryan was taken to the hospital for symptoms of shock. At around 2 p.m., he posted on Facebook that he was okay. Hospital staff determined that he was uninjured and ultimately released him. Ryan then went back to his parents' house on Old Dover Road, where the Kentucky State Police were processing the scene. They had been called in by the Cadiz police, who were unequipped to deal with such a massive crime. KSB Sergeant Brett Miller told Oxygen that in his 20-year career, the Champion family murders was probably the worst crime scene he had ever seen. Besides the bodies of Joy, Lindsay, and Emily, KSP investigators had also located a fourth body near the front door. It was of a young man. Local officers told the KSP that the man was not a member of the Champion family and they didn't recognize him. When Miller found out that Ryan was back at the scene, he went outside to get his account of what happened just before 11:45 a.m. that morning. Ryan told Sergeant Miller that he was home alone with Emily, hanging out in the living room, when they suddenly heard someone come inside the house. At first, they thought it was their parents home early from church, but it wasn't. The person inside the home was a man named Vito. Ryan said he had only met him a few days earlier. He said the only thing he knew about Vito was that he was obsessed with Emily. Ryan said that Vito had a gun and two rolls of duct tape, one in each hand. In the living room, he pointed the gun at Ryan and told him if he did anything stupid, he would hurt Emily. Vito taped the siblings to chairs, starting with Ryan, since he was the bigger threat. When he was done, Vito told them not to move. If they complied, he wouldn't hurt anyone. At that moment, Joy and Lindsay really did come home from church. Ryan said Vito then took off running out the side door. Not long after that, Ryan said he heard gunshots ring out. Then Vito ran back inside and shot Emily twice. And then he turned the gun on Ryan, shoving it in his face. But then Vito realized the gun's clip was empty, so he put a new one in. That's when Ryan made a move and fought Vito off. He said he grabbed the gun, shot Vito in the head, then ran to his Aunt Lisa's. Sergeant Miller felt that Ryan's story checked out on the surface. When investigators looked at the ID in the man's wallet, they found that his name was Vito Reservato. He was 22 years old. Authorities told the public that they believed Vito shot and killed the Champions before he was shot. They mentioned that another member of the Champion family had been present during the attack and had survived. They did not identify Ryan or give any other details to the press. News that the killer was dead helped calm Katie's residents, who were very shaken up over the brutal murders of three community members. But they had no idea that investigators were not done with the case yet. They still had some digging to do, starting with figuring out who Vito Reservato was and why he would want to kill the Champion family. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. As a Southern Fried listener, you know the world can sometimes be a scary place. But no matter what happens out there, home should be the safest place there is for you and your family. That's why I recommend Simply Safe Home Security. Simply Safe is advanced whole home security that puts you, your home, and your family's safety first. Working from home means I am alone a lot, and often up in my studio where I can't hear anything. SimpliSafe's cameras, right at my fingertips, have made me feel so much safer. SimpliSafe offers comprehensive protection with 24/7 monitoring, not only against intruders and burglary, but also against expensive home hazards, from flooding to fires. SimpliSafe uses proprietary video verification technology so that monitoring agents can visually confirm the threat in order to get higher priority 911 dispatch. Monitoring plans are affordably priced at $1 a day with no long-term contract or hidden fees because feeling safe at home shouldn't break the bank. You can customize the perfect system for your home in just a few minutes at simplysafe.com/southernfried. Go today and claim a free indoor security camera plus 20% off with interactive monitoring. Go to simplysafe.com/southernfried. Now, a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. As a writer, I do my best to take care of my mind. Brain breaks, as I call them, are so important. I need to stay alert and focused, so I plan small breaks to engage my brain, whether it's a game on my phone or reading a couple of chapters in a book. There are plenty of ways to support a healthy brain, like learning a new language or taking power naps. There's also BetterHelp Online Therapy. I've been through a lot in the last few years with surgeries and losing my mom, so I have depended so much on therapy to help me through it. BetterHelp has made it so much easier to connect with someone I feel safe talking to. They offer video, phone, and even live chat only therapy sessions, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. And it's much more affordable than in-person therapy. You can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Southern Fried listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/southern. That's BETTERHELP.com/southern. Investigators found that Vito Reservato was born in Vegas on July 5, 1992. He moved to Tennessee in 2004, and 2 years later he was in Kentucky, where he would stay until his death. In 2010, Vito graduated from Hopkinsville High School. While there, he was in JROTC. A friend, Andre Collins, told WSMV that Vito was really popular in a way, really nice. No one ever saw him having problems with anybody else. According to his Facebook, Vito then attended the culinary arts program at Sullivan University. In August 2014, Vito and his one-year-old son Adrian moved into a house in Hopkinsville. They lived with six other roommates. And that's about all we really know about Vito. There was one glaring thing that stood out to investigators during their deep dive into Vito. He had no criminal history. None at all. Investigators were pretty surprised. Why would somebody with a clean background murder three members of a family he barely knew? It just didn't make a lot of sense. So they went back to Ryan and asked how Vito had become so obsessed with Emily that he would want to kill her whole family. Ryan explained that he had met Vito 3 days before the murders on October 23rd. Vito was down on his luck, so Ryan agreed to hire him for a construction job. He brought Vito over to his parents' home to get some tools. That's where Vito met Emily and became fixated on her. So much so that Ryan feared for Emily. After Vito started making inappropriate comments, Ryan let him go. While investigators worked to corroborate Ryan's story, he started speaking with the media. On October 27th, just a day after the murders, Ryan spoke with CBS affiliate WTVF in a now infamous interview. To start the interview, the reporter said to Ryan, "The first question in all this, how are you personally holding up? You seem remarkably composed." He replied, I've got one of those mentalities to soldier through something. Really, that's what's been carrying me through. To be honest, I don't really know yet, really, how to feel about any of it yet." He went on, "And it never really set in until it took a good hour to sink in." Ryan explained that around an hour after the murders, he was taken to the hospital for some form of shock. He said he was very unnaturally dehydrated, and his throat was dry, and continues to go dry when he talks about it. He said that he couldn't cry tears, and that his nerves were shot, and he was shaking. The WTVF reporter asked Ryan how Vito knew the family. Ryan said he wasn't supposed to go into too much detail, due to the ongoing investigation, but what he could say was that Vito was, quote, a new person to all of us. His relationship to us was only a couple of days old. When asked if he thought he was going to die right along with his family, Ryan replied, "Very much so. I was constantly trying to zone on if I could do something. I was always looking for an opportunity, but it was so confusing. I read in one news report that my hands were bound, so I know I can say that. It's a tricky situation. There's not a lot that anybody could do. Ryan continued on, quote, "He wasn't acting in a way that constituted immediate physical harm, and I just didn't want to agitate the situation." He said, "Then Mom and Dad drove up. He said an expletive many times in a row and then just ran out. I thought that was it. We were in the clear. He knows they can call the cops, so he's running for the hills. That's not what happened." The reporter then asked Ryan how he had overpowered Vito. Ryan said, quote, "It wasn't much of a decision at all. It happened so fast. I'm sure the details will be allowed to come out soon enough, but for now, everything was erratic and confusing, and I really wish I could give you some insight." Ryan added, "At the last point, after he made his last move, I was able to engage him. He made two mistakes. He got too close to me, and his gun needed reloading. His head was down." Then Ryan was told not to go into any further detail by someone off camera. To end the interview, the reporter asked Ryan about his parents. He paused for 8 seconds, sighed, and replied, "My parents were," and then there was another multi-second pause, "unbelievably good people, unbelievably good people," he said. There was another pause, this one 3 seconds long, including another sigh. Then Ryan changed the subject. The reporter's question to Ryan about his parents was longer than his actual reply. "I told Haley that I thought about pausing here for exactly 8 seconds, just so you can remember how awkwardly long that really is in a television interview. But I was afraid some people might think there was something wrong with the audio and cut it off." Anyway, Ryan went on to say, quote, "This guy, he was awkward at best when he talked to people. He kind of had a vibe that would make old people uneasy, and that factors into this. He came over a previous night and said something about how he ran out of gas. Mom was scared seeing somebody that late at night. Dad came out to talk to him, and his story was that he ran out of gas down the road." He continued, "Despite all the bad connotations, my dad went and got 5 gallons of gas and took it to his truck. That's what people should know about my dad. He would help anybody. That's who he was." This was the first time in the whole interview where Ryan appears to be genuinely choked up. Tears welled up in his eyes as he talked about how his mother was the same way. Quote, "They were so good, they didn't know what bad looked like. When Mom told me about him coming over that night, she says she wasn't scared. It was just that it was rude for him to walk through the field that late at night. She couldn't understand bad. That's how good they were." According to CBS, aside from speaking with the media, Ryan also posted updates on Facebook about how he needed money and was trying to work odd jobs to pay for gas and bills. He also posted things about the murders like, quote, "I cried so much I dehydrated myself that day," and that he still gets weak talking about the murders. On October 28th, 2 days after the murders, authorities told the media that they weren't searching for other suspects. However, the case was not closed yet. They said, "We're still trying to fit some pieces into the puzzle about the whole situation." That same day, one of Vito's roommates, Ariel, told WSMV that Ryan and Vito knew each other way more than Ryan let on in his interview. The two men were friends and had been for some time. Ariel said she had only come forward after watching Ryan's October 27th interview with WTVF. She couldn't sit back and let Ryan lie to everyone. Ariel explained to the station that Vito was normally happy, chatty, and upbeat, but around 3 weeks before the murders, he changed. Ariel said, quote, "He got let go from his job, so he was struggling with money. He was upset because he couldn't afford anything for his son." Then around a week before the murders, Vito was back to being really happy. Ariel told the station that, quote, "Somebody told him that he would pay a certain amount of money, like an extreme amount of money, to kill somebody." Ariel told Vito that he was crazy if he did it. Vito never told Ariel or any of his other roommates that he had plans to murder someone. They just figured he was full of it. On the day of the murders, Vito came down the stairs, threw his phone on the couch, and told Ariel he would be back in 2 to 3 hours. Ariel said she could tell something was wrong. She had no idea just how right she was. Ariel told WSMV that she had a hard time believing Vito would kill people he barely knew. She said, quote, "I feel like Vito was set up. Vito needs justice like everybody else needs justice. I'm not saying Vito's innocent. If Vito did it, he's in the wrong. Nobody deserves death, but I hope he gets justice." Ariel's interview made investigators look more closely into Ryan's relationship with Vito and the Champion family murders in general. They already had a list of unanswered questions, which now seemed more suspicious than ever. For example, if Ryan fought off Vito the way he said he did, why didn't Ryan have any marks or scratches on him? And why would Vito kill Emily, the woman he was obsessed with? To them, it would make more sense if he kept her alive. Investigators spoke with Vito's 6 roommates to find out more about this guy who said he would pay a lot of money for Vito to kill someone. The roommate said that Vito had gotten a new job with a guy named Ryan, and he was the one who hired Vito to kill 3 people for a grand total of $30,000. All of his roommates thought Vito was full of it. They never thought he would actually kill anyone. They knew that he was actually terrified of guns. Everyone who knew Vito knew that. Investigators had more questions than ever. Why would someone who was scared of guns agree to kill 3 strangers? And furthermore, how likely was it that someone with 0 experience with guns was able to shoot Joy, Lindsay, and Emily in the head so expertly? None of Ryan Champion's story was adding up. On October 29th, Sergeant Miller brought Ryan back to the scene of the crime and had him reenact the entire attack. For the most part, Ryan repeated the same story he had told before. Vito showed up with a gun and duct tape. He taped Ryan and Emily up and then held them at gunpoint. When Lindsay and Joy came home, Vito went outside and killed them. He ran back inside, past Ryan, shot Emily in the head, and then turned to Ryan. But Vito was out of bullets and had to reload. That's when Ryan seized the opportunity to fight back. He got the gun, shot Vito, and then ran to Lisa's. Sergeant Miller later spoke with Oxygen about how the reenactment went, stating, quote, "There was nothing believable that he said that matched logic. For example, when Ryan talked about Vito running past him to shoot Emily, Ryan said Vito told me, 'Excuse me.' That certainly defies logic. What kind of murderer would take time to say, 'Excuse me?'" There was another issue with Ryan's story. The gun clip Vito supposedly used to kill everyone could only hold 7 bullets. Before Vito reloaded his magazine, he had shot Lindsay 4 times, Joy 2 times, and Emily 4 times, for a total of 10 bullets. That meant Vito could not have been reloading when Ryan took the gun from him. After the reenactment, Ryan was taken to the station for more questioning, where their interview turned into an interrogation. Ryan repeatedly told Sergeant Miller that he did not kill his family, but Miller told Ryan it wasn't even a question any longer. Miller knew Ryan killed his family. He just had to find enough evidence to charge him. Ryan left the police station that day a free man, but investigators were not giving up anytime soon. They continued looking into every aspect of the crime, hoping to find something worthy of an arrest warrant. Meanwhile, family members planned Joy, Lindsay, and Emily's funeral. Joy's sister Judy told Oxygen that when the family went to the Champion house to pick out clothes for their caskets, they saw Ryan there. It was really awkward because they all had a feeling Ryan was involved in the murders. His story just did not add up. But none of them wanted to alienate Ryan in case he slipped up, so they acted like everything was fine. Judy said it was really hard to look at him and think, "You did this." The family members all feared for their safety, especially at the upcoming funeral. They wondered what else Ryan was capable of and who was next. Would he attack them at the funeral? Investigators knew the family was hoping for an arrest before the funeral, so they worked hard to find more evidence. They recalled that Ryan said Vito taped him up first because he was the biggest threat. But if Ryan had actually been the person to tape up Emily, like investigators thought he was, he likely would have taped himself up last. So they examined the duct tape rolls found in the Champion house, as well as the tape on Emily and Ryan's wrists. The edge left on one of the rolls was a perfect match to the tape from one of Ryan's wrists. Ryan's story was finally falling apart. It was the link investigators were looking for. They now theorized that Ryan hired Vito to murder his parents and sister, but then Ryan ended up turning on Vito, killing him to avoid paying the $30,000 hitman fee. Investigators weren't sure of Ryan's motive yet, but they didn't need a motive in order to obtain an arrest warrant. On October 31st, Ryan was arrested and charged with one count of murder for Vito, three counts of complicity to commit murder for his family members, and one count of complicity to commit kidnapping for Emily because she had been restrained with duct tape. According to Sergeant Miller, Ryan was shocked when officers showed up to arrest him. He was ultimately held on a $5 million bond, $1 million for each count, and the prosecution announced that they would be seeking the death penalty. The Commonwealth's attorney told the media that the Champion family murders started out as a murder-for-hire scheme for Vito, but it didn't end up that way. Vito would have got paid, but he was murdered. Investigators told the media that the case wasn't completely closed yet, stating, quote, "We're still looking at Vito's involvement. He was involved in the incident, but we just determined that Ryan had much more involvement than he had stated." Ryan's family was at the funeral home finishing up plans when they found out Ryan had finally been arrested. Everyone breathed a sigh of relief that they wouldn't have to face Ryan at the funeral. They could grieve in peace, not having to see him pretend like he cared. On November 2nd, Lindsay Joy and Emily's combined funeral was held in the Trigg County High School gym with nearly 2,000 mourners attending. Brother Randall Evans of the Katy's Church of Christ addressed the crowd saying, "Whatever reason you've come, we're glad you're here today. Because today we came to remember and to honor the Champion family, not just the tragic end to their earthly existence, but for the marvelous lives they lived while here." The Champion family members were buried next to each other. Later, an elaborate memorial was built for them in the cemetery. A week or so after he was indicted, Ryan spoke to WKDZ WHVO radio, continuing to maintain his innocence. He said the evidence against him wasn't as strong as everyone was led to believe. Ryan told the radio station, "I know what happened. I was there and who did what." He declared, "I really look forward to a time when I can get out of here, but I'm really looking forward to, either way, leaving all of this behind me and trying to dig back up a normal life and grieve for my family in a way that I have not yet been allowed to." I'm going to pause now for a final commercial break. After his arrest, they received a tip that on October 21st, 5 days before the murders, a man who knew the Champion family saw Ryan at a Waffle House. He was there with an unknown woman, and none other than Vito Reservato. Considering the fact that Ryan said he met Vito on October 23rd, investigators were intrigued by this tip. They looked at the Waffle House security footage and saw Ryan, Vito, and the woman eating together. Investigators recognized the woman. It was Ann Plotkin, a longtime friend of Ryan's. He had actually told investigators about her on the night of the murders. Ryan said if investigators wanted proof of Vito's obsession with Emily, they could speak with Anne. She knew all about it. Investigators did speak with Anne and found that she and Ryan had a romantic relationship. They had known each other for years, and he was her, quote, ride-or-die partner. Anne told them that Ryan was innocent. Vito was definitely the man responsible. Investigators knew that Anne had been a very outspoken advocate for Ryan following his arrest. On November 5th, she told 48 Hours that she was the one who introduced Ryan and Vito. She said it was a few weeks before the murders. Ryan then hired Vito to work with him on a tiling job because he knew Vito needed the money. Anne said, quote, "That's just the way Ryan was. If he knew it would benefit you, he would give you the shirt off his back." After hiring Vito, Ryan introduced him to the Champion family. That's when Vito allegedly became obsessed with Emily. Anne said Ryan had to fire Vito before their tiling job was even complete because Vito was talking crazy. Anne told 48 Hours that when she heard about the murders on the news, her jaw hit the floor. She immediately thought Vito was the killer and that Ryan had killed him in self-defense. Anne sniffed that she had tried to tell all of this to the police, but they wouldn't listen to her. I find that comment unlikely. This was a murder investigation. The detectives were definitely listening. Anne believed Ryan to be innocent, stating, quote, "Anybody who knows Ryan, any of his close friends, knows he's not capable of doing this. The allegations were complete and total BS." She insisted that Vito was guilty. She knew he was a violent, mentally ill man because he had previously dated her daughter. After the 48 Hours interview, Anne continued sticking up for Ryan, often taking to Facebook to post about her Bubba, who would always be number one in her heart. Following the Waffle House tip, investigators went to speak with Anne Plotkin again. They pressed her for information and asked if there were any messages between her, Ryan, and Vito. Anne replied no, then hastily started deleting text messages off of her phone. Investigators realized what was happening and seized her phone for evidence. Anne was allowed to leave the station, but the police kept her phone. She had no idea that deleting those texts in front of investigators was the worst thing she could have done. They now had enough probable cause to get a warrant for Anne's text messages and social media accounts, along with Ryan's and Vito's. What investigators found was extremely damning. Anne had acted as the messenger between Ryan and Vito while they were plotting the Champion family murders. They never directly communicated via social media or text. They always went through Anne. Investigators now knew that she had actively participated in planning the murders of Joy, Lindsay, and Emily Champion. In February 2015, a warrant for 41-year-old Anne's arrest was obtained. She resisted arrest, but in the end, she was taken into custody and charged with 3 counts of complicity to commit capital murder and 1 count of resisting arrest. Investigators thought they knew Anne's motive for helping Ryan plan the murders. It was simple, really. Anne loved Ryan and wanted to be with him. She would do anything for him. Sergeant Miller told Oxygen that he thinks Ryan's feelings were not mutual. He was likely just using Anne. While they had Anne's motive, investigators were still working to figure out Ryan's. After speaking with an ex-girlfriend of Ryan's, they had more insight than ever. His ex told police that whenever Ryan's parents were brought up in conversation, he would get very angry. His face would turn red and he'd start shaking. Ryan hated his family. A lot. Possibly enough to brutally snuff out their lives. Ryan's ex told police that she believed Ryan felt very belittled by his parents because Emily was accomplished. She was the celebrated equine veterinarian, while he couldn't hold down a job. Lindsay's sister Lisa told Oxygen that Ryan thought his parents loved Emily more than him, and he had felt that way for a long, long time. As the siblings got older, Lisa noticed that whenever Emily got attention, Ryan would do anything to get the attention back on him. Authorities now believed that part of Ryan's motive could have been jealousy of his sister and the perceived favoritism from his parents. But friends and family felt that Ryan should not have felt that way. Lindsay and Joy loved their children equally and always treated them the same. Investigators spoke to many people and never found any evidence that Ryan was mistreated by his parents. No one ever had a bad word to say about the Champions, but for some reason, Ryan was convinced that his parents truly loved and cared for Emily more than him. It must have eaten him up inside. During the investigation, two other possible motives came up. The first is that some family members believe Ryan had a financial motive for his parents' death. He had recently been evicted and was having a hard time. With his family dead, he would inherit the family house, land, and at least a little bit of money. Ryan wouldn't have to work for a while or worry about having a roof over his head. The second possible motive stems from the fact that prior to the murders, Joy and Lindsay were planning on adding an addition to the house. Ryan told his parents that he wanted to do the addition, but they told him no, it was beyond his capabilities as a contractor. Authorities theorized that this no may have pushed Ryan over the edge. He felt he could never compete with Emily, and now he was not good enough to even work on his parents' home. Because Ryan had never confessed to what happened on October 26, 2014, no one can really be sure what his exact motive was. There are only theories. The same goes for what actually happened that day. Sergeant Miller believes Vito did not carry out the murders before Ryan killed him. The reason Miller believes this is because the kill shots were all to the head. Vito had zero gun experience. No one had ever even seen him shoot a gun. In fact, he was known to be scared of them. Ryan, on the other hand, was in the military and would know how to handle a gun and precisely where to shoot. The Commonwealth's attorney told Oxygen that she believes Ryan killed his family, then killed Vito to eliminate the only witness. All authorities seem to agree that Vito did not murder anyone before his own life was taken. Ryan was responsible for all four murders. Despite never confessing, on December 8, 2016, in order to save himself from the possibility of the death penalty, 38-year-old Ryan pled guilty to four counts of murder and one count of kidnapping. Following Ryan's plea, Lindsay's sister Lisa told the Paducah Sun, "It's something we'll never get over. Honestly, I've often said that we may as well have perished with them because of the quality of our lives afterward and what we've had to deal with because we were all very close." Lisa told Oxygen that it's a struggle every day to look across the street and see the house where her family was slaughtered. In January 2017, Ryan's sentencing hearing was held. The Commonwealth attorney stated, "It's an awful case. There's nothing good that can be said about this case or the facts of it." She said surviving family members approved the plea agreement because it did give them closure and certainty. Without the plea, they would have gone to trial. And if Ryan had been sentenced to death, he would have had years and years of appeals before he was actually executed. It was way too much for the traumatized family to go through. "I have often pointed out to people who debate the death penalty that regardless of how you feel morally, the automatic appeals process is a continued trauma for loved ones." According to WPSD, this hearing was the first time Ryan's family spoke to him since the murders. Joy's sister Judy told Ryan, "I cry every day wondering what my sister thought in those last few moments of her life when she walked into the basement and saw you standing there with a gun in your hand. The shock and disbelief she must have felt to see her son standing there, knowing she was going to die by his hand. There is no punishment great enough for what you've done. Our family is broken and devastated and will never recover. We will always be living one day at a time. Judy added that Ryan didn't have compassion or a soul. That part of a person that makes them human is missing in you. Lindsay's sister, Lisa, is the one who gave the quote I opened the show with. But she also told her nephew, quote, "There are some days I don't want to do anything but sleep. I have nightmares of my family. I have daymares of my family's deaths. I have guilt if I laugh, because I think my family can no longer laugh." Lisa said, "The words gun and bullet caused me to flinch, knowing that my family was killed by such. I cannot even use gray duct tape anymore, because when I see gray duct tape, all I see is the image of Emily, her face and head taped up, her little hands taped up like mittens." Remember, Lisa was the one who walked in and found her family members. That horrific scene would be forever etched in her memory. Lindsay's brother, Lauren, however, gave a much different statement. He let Ryan know that he forgave him. Quote, "I truly believe with all my heart that that is what my late brother, your late father, and Jesus wants me to do. And that's to forgive you, Ryan." Following the family's victim impact statements, the Commonwealth attorney told the court, "The pain and the loss that he is responsible for is unspeakable and unfathomable." During all the statements, Ryan did not appear to be remorseful, and he never addressed the court. At the end of the hearing, the judge sentenced Ryan to 5 life without parole terms. Months later, on May 19, 2017, 42-year-old Ann Plotkin pled guilty to 3 counts of complicity to murder. According to the Paducah Sun, Ann sat silently and expressionless, listening to the statements of surviving family members. Jody's sister Judy faced Ann and said, "You sentenced Joy, Lindsay, and Emily to death, and the rest of my family to life without them. They touched more lives, made more memories, and loved more deeply than you could in 3 lifetimes. They didn't deserve to die, and you don't deserve to live." According to the Paducah Sun, Ann offered no words of remorse or apology for what she had done. She was sentenced to 22 years behind bars. On February 4, 2019, the parole board held an emergency hearing to discuss whether or not 45-year-old Ann should be released from prison and placed on probation due to a terminal illness. The Champion family went to the hearing to oppose her release. On October 7th, the board denied Ann's request. She died the next day. As of this recording, 43-year-old Ryan is incarcerated in the Eastern Kentucky Correctional Complex in West Liberty. Pending any successful appeals, he will die in prison, where he belongs. When Haley and I first talked about this case, I found it hard not to sympathize some with Ryan Champion, as wrong as that may sound. It is incredibly hurtful, demoralizing, and corrosive to the soul to believe that your parents favor a sibling over you, even if it's not true and it's all in your mind. Compound that with the natural feelings of loss and being different because you were adopted. That is an ache that festers, a sore tooth you can't stop running your tongue over. Many people who are adopted and given great childhoods with parents who adore them still report an emptiness, a loss, a hole in their heart. Ryan would have been no different. He certainly felt inferior to his high-achieving sister, which I think led to his dangerous jealousy. He was perceived as being cold in court, of having no remorse. And yet he pled guilty, even though he would not or could not confess. Maybe he couldn't face what he did. Maybe his pride wouldn't allow him to admit the deep-seated pain that had destroyed his soul. And maybe he was just a cold-blooded killer. He snuffed out 4 lives, 3 of whom loved him dearly. Lindsay, Joy, and Emily were not aware of the cold stone that had slowly replaced Ryan's heart. Not until the moment he looked them in the eye and brutally shot them all to death. And now, there is a hole in the heart of every loved one they were taken away from. Southern Fried True Crime is hosted and produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was written by Haley Gray and myself and was researched by Haley Gray. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. If you have any case suggestions, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, and go to the listener suggestion tab. This is the best way for me to get those little-known cases y'all always send me. Please remember that I do not accept suggestions on social media private messages. With 3 platforms to manage, that is very overwhelming for me. I hope you understand. But please do come join our Facebook group, Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group, where we swap recipes, worship Dolly Parton, and share memes. I much prefer spending my social media time in our lovely group. We do, of course, discuss true crime, not just Southern Fried, but all kinds. But it is still very much a Southern lifestyle group. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook, and by God, we mean it when we say no shit ass is allowed. It's not just a motto, it's how we run the group. If you enjoyed today's show, please don't forget to subscribe and tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on all large platforms like iHeart, Stitcher, and Spotify. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.